are continuing on our oral history of POU, and this is the next few tapes will be vignettes about people I have known at POU through the years, such as faculty members, students, families, employees. Whatever comes to mind, I'll just be tossing them in here. One of the most colorful members of the faculty through the years was a man by the name of J.P. Flieger, P-F-L-U-E-G-E-R. Flieger, I first met Flieger back in the 1920s. Flieger was a graduate of Capital Seminary, and after one World War, he had gone to also to study tropical medicine at Tulane University, and while there he met this French girl. They were married. I believe that's where he met her. And anyway, he wanted to be a missionary to India, but then World War II broke out, and because he was a German background, or World War I, I mean, because he was German background, he couldn't get off the ship in India, and he went on to the Philippines, and eventually came back to the United States. So he never did get to realize his dream of becoming a missionary, but he did wind up as a pastor of the American Lutheran Church, and he was pastor of Queen Anne Lutheran in Seattle. Flieger's had five boys and a girl in their family. And some of the boys were same age as I, so we were together in high school together at Queen Anne in Seattle because we lived on the south end of Queen Anne Hill, and Queen Anne Lutheran was up on top of the hill, and we saw each other once in a while. First time I remember Dr. Flieger was in 1925 when Pacific Lutheran Cemetery was dedicated, and he was a marvelous speaker, and he gave the oration at the dedication out there by alongside Wash Shelley Cemetery, north end of Seattle, just off of 115th in Aurora. Well, Flieger went down to Pacific Lutheran as a professor in 1930. That's when the American Lutheran Council was formed, and the old American Lutheran Church came in to support Pacific Lutheran. And the one way they did of support was to take care of Dr. Flieger. They paid his salary all through the years. And that was a godsend, because a lot of the other, he never would have been able to make it otherwise with a family his size. As they're in the depths of the Depression, the other people weren't getting their salaries at PLU. But Flieger always got his salary, got some of his salary anyway, directly from the American Lutheran Church. They continued that for a number of years until out in the 40s. Well, Flieger was a colorful individual. He taught, I had him for teacher, and he's one of the greatest teachers I ever had. He taught, the time I was there, he taught ethics and religion. He taught public address. So I had him for my religion teacher, my ethics teacher, and philosophy. He taught philosophy and speech. And he was colorful. He had a lot of interests. The result was his lectures were always something that you enjoyed. And he loved his students. There was a close relationship between faculty, between him and the student body, with the result that we got a great deal of inspiration from him. And all of those who were fortunate enough to have him as teacher will never forget him. Well, he was a sports fan, and he was a trainer for the athletic teams in the dock. He'd go with them, he'd be there at the football games and the basketball games. He would cheer for the team. You could hear him yelling up in the stands in football games, "Roll them back, boys, roll them back." You could hear him in the basketball games. He'd get on the officials. And then when the people would say, "Well, you shouldn't boo the officials like that and shouldn't razz them," he'd say, he says, "It's my Christian duty to do that very thing." He said, if they're doing a bad job, it's our duty to let them know that they're doing a poor job. And we have a responsibility to do that. Of course, we laugh with him and at him about that. particular thing. But he was also very vociferous in his leanings towards, I mean, in his feelings towards other things in daily life and Christian life. He was not a legalist, and he spoke out against legalism in Christianity. But he was a wholesome Christian person, very devout. His chapel talks were always good. He would write out his chapel talks and memorize them. And they were inspiring. But he hated microphones, public address systems. When Eastfold Chapel was opened in 1952, he came on stage there to speak. And he saw that microphone, and he got way off the side of it, and he refused everything to do with it. And he had a big, powerful voice, and he wasn't about to have it spoiled in his thinking by a public address system. And he did that up until his day, until he retired from PLU in 1960. He just had nothing to do with the PA system. His wife preceded him in death. All of his children went to Pacific Lutheran. Dr. Jesse Flieger, who's now over in, he started out as a school teacher, then he went into medicine, and he's over at Ephrata, general practitioner. He's also a member of the Board of Regents now in 1974-75. And the next one is William Adam, who's exactly my age, and Willie is with the Wycliffe Bible Translators, and down in California as a business manager for them. Next one is Gerhardt, who is a pastor at down in California. He was in Los Altos for a number of years. Now he's moved recently. I think it's I don't know the name of the place now where he is, but it's nearby in the Bay Area, if I remember correctly. The next one is Raymond. Gary. Gary's next. Gary is a professor of music at Augustana College in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. And the next one is Raymond, and he is was a pastor, but he has been out of the ministry now since about 1970, and he is with a business. He's in business, in insurance business over in Pasco, Washington. And the youngest is Marilyn, who is married to Gerhard Schmuderer, who is the head of the foreign language department at Augustana College in Sioux Falls. So that's, and all of them are graduates of Pacific Lutheran. In the junior, of course, when some of them were there, it was junior college, and they went on to CAP to finish. Ray, Gerhardt, Willie went back to CAP too, and what's his name? Gerhardt went. He took education, and then got his medicine at the University of Washington, so he didn't go back there. That's the Fliegers. They were a wonderful family and made terrific contributions to the life of PLU. Flieger was also quite a... He had a lot of hobbies. He liked archery, made his own bows and arrows. He liked to... he was a wood carver and a sculptor. He also... he was a connoisseur of art. He was... a civic leader. He's a very, very influential person. But he's remembered primarily for his wonderful work as a teacher and for his rapport with the students. Speaking of that, six children of his went to PLU. And there's another family that had a lot of children at PLU. It was the Wrights, R-E-I-T-Z family. That's a family of 10, and also an American Lutheran Church pastor. He was Reverend Otto Wrights. Yeah, I think the father's name was Otto, if I remember correctly. He's still living. He and his wife live over in Hermiston, Oregon, where they're retired. But they had 10 children. 9 of them attended PLU. The last one to graduate was Carl, K-A-R-L, back in Oh, around 1961 or 62, somewhere in there, if I remember correctly. And he's a teacher of math at Chapman College down in California. And then there's, I can't remember the names of all these Wrightses who were at PLU, but they were quite a family. And the interesting thing about it was that the parents never didn't have the money to help these children, but every one of them earned their own way through school. Some of them had to borrow money, and they paid it off after they got out, but they all got themselves a college education, which I think is fantastic. A lot of people say, well, it costs so much to go to PLU and so forth and so on, and we just can't make it. And I just remind them of the Wrights family. And I say, here's a family where the parents didn't give them, or did not have the money to help the children, because they had a big family and they were in small parishes, not much of a salary, never had much of a salary. And so these kids, they worked, every one of them worked while they were going to college. They worked in the summertime and vacation time and got the college education, and they got it at PLU, and none of them were very good at it. Then another family with, there's been a lot of other families with quite a few children at PLU. There's a Knutson family, K-N-U-T-S-O-N, from up in Everett. There was Leif and Olive, Edna and Will, Sheila, and a couple others. There were six of them went to PLU in the 40s, right after the war. In the 40s, there were three of them there at one time, I remember. And then up until mid-50s. Or maybe it was Sheila, I guess, graduated around 1960. Their folks didn't have much in the line of this world as good as these kids had to help themselves. So, of course, some of them went on the GI Bill because they'd been in the service. One of the girls had been a nurse in the service, and so she got a GI Bill to help her through. But we had, they were, one interesting thing about Leif, he was a track star at PLU. He ran the 880, but he didn't like the idea that students were getting help in sports. I found this out years later. I didn't realize at the time that he was so opposed to the athletic scholarship program we had. Felt that students that were turning out for sports were getting more help than they should. Well, in those days, in the late 40s, right after the war, the schools in our conference were giving free tuition to students in football. They had a certain number of scholarships, football and basketball, and we also gave room and board to some of these kids. And then finally in 51 or 52, they called a screeching halt the whole thing and cut it down to half tuition because it was just getting away. Well, so Leif maybe had a point, but Leif never said anything to anybody. He just didn't turn out for his senior year. He just said he wasn't interested in turning out anymore. And in his junior year, he had won the conference, he had set a record for the 880 for a PLU record and won the conference meet. Another family that had quite a few were the the George Knutsons, K-N-U-T-Z-E-N, the George Knutsons from up at Burlington. Let's see how many of them went to PLU. There was Elmer, Vern, Floyd, Grace, Ruth, that's it. There were five children in the family. They all went to PLU. A lot of other Knutsons from up there who were related. We used to call Burlington Knutsonville. There was Einar Knutson, who later became a member of the Board of Regents and was very active in the support of the university. Einar was the son of Chris Knutson. Chris Knutson was on the board back in the 40s, and he was a staunch supporter of PLU. He didn't go to college. He was a Danish immigrant. But he's the one that gave the elevator in Harstead Hall. And we gave that in 1948, because I think it was something like $20,000 at that time he gave to have that elevator installed. And it was from his estate that the money came for Christensen Fellowship Hall. Christensen Fellowship Hall originally was a part of what is now Ingram Hall. It was a wing that was built on between what was then called the College Union Building and what is now Ordall Hall. That wing there, which is a has a kind of scalloped arches, you know, in the ceiling. That was called Christensen, in memory of Christensen, who gave a considerable sum of money through his will and through Sunniner to PLU. So that went to pay for that wing. I think it was something like $50,000 or $75,000. I forget just what it was. And then when the University Center was built, we felt that the name should be kept on campus, even though that building would be transformed into an art department. So we took the name over to University Center, and the fellowship hall there is called Christensen. It's spelled all kinds of ways, but the correct spelling is C-H-R-I-S, capital K-N-U-T-Z-E-N. Chris was a man who made his money in farming, especially in the raising of grass and the processing of it for feed for cattle. And his son, Einar, continued that up until he said, he told me now that he's going to discontinue it for 75. 74 was the last year he was doing it. He said it was just too much to keep it up because of all the requirements of by the anti-pollution forces, ecologists, and so forth. He just, it would cost him so much to change over his system and make improvements, the type of things that are required, that he just couldn't come out ahead. But he still has his farms and acreage where he raises peas for canning, for cold pack, freezing, fresh frozen. And he has other things that he raises up there. Now that we've had other families that come to mind that have been around PLU is the Mays family from over in La Crosse, Washington. That's Bill Mays was the father, and they had four children at PLU. The two oldest, Charlie and Tom, were twins. Tom played football for a couple years at PLU back in was around 1958, 59, 59, 60, right in there. And then he just couldn't get along with the coach at that time, Jim Gabrielson, so he went over to Washington State. He didn't play any football over there, but he went over there and took courses in industrial arts, and then gradually went out into teaching. And later on, believe it or not, came to PLU as a member of the PE staff one year when we needed somebody to fill in while a person was on leave. He's now coach of football down at R.A. Long High School in Longview, Washington. Then another one that then his other brother, his twin brother, Charles, graduated 62, I think it was Charlie graduated. Charlie was president of student body. He was manager of athletic teams. He was into all kinds of things. And he was had a brilliant mind. He graduated with honors. He was a wonderful young man. Later went on to Luther Seminary. Graduated from there. Went out and served a parish in Fairfax, Virginia. When he graduated, been there for a few years until 74, he came out here to the state of Washington to Renton, where he's establishing a home mission congregation for the American Lutheran Church. Another one in the family is, there were two girls. Next was Linda. Linda was very active in student life too, and she was editor of the yearbook, and I was advisor to that yearbook, and she later became She went out in a teaching game, married a fellow from taught in the Puyallup area, and then she met a fellow, and they were from Montana. They were married. He was a teacher over here too, and then he went over to Montana. I mean, they went over to Montana a couple of years ago, about 73, and they live and teach over there. Then the youngest one is Sandy, not Sandy, but Nancy. Sandy's Charlie's wife, Sandy Erickson, from up at Port Angeles, also a PLU grad. Well, that's interesting. You have Tom married a PLU girl too, a girl from his hometown of La Crosse. And, but Nancy, the youngest, she was also editor of the yearbook. She worked in the university relations office. At the time she went to college, her father had sold out or liquidated the business over there in La Crosse. He was a farm implement man and also a farmer, and moved over to Tacoma. And so she worked in our office, in university relations office, while she was going to college. And then when she graduated, she went into social work, and she's doing that in Tacoma. She's doing a fine piece of work. Another family, we had four of them at one. We had four of them at one time, from Kellogg, Idaho, the Hagerman kids. There's Jess, and boy, the girls, the names of all those gals. There was Peggy. I just can't come up with them just this minute now. Come to me, Pat Hagerman, Peggy. It was Pat, Patricia. Well, anyway, they were all there at one time in the 60s. One of the years, there was all four of them in school. And I know there have been other families where there are several, and four or more from the same family have attended PLU, and those names will come to me as we go along. Now I want to talk a little bit about some other characters we had around school. One of the interesting ones was a professor when I was there. His name was Peter Jeremiah Bardon, B-A-R-D-O-N. He taught political science and various other courses, both in the high school level and the college level. He was big, tall, angular fellow who had been a wrestler back in Crookston, Minnesota, years before he came out west. When I was there in the 30s, he was getting up in years, getting around 60, and he was but still in good health. His family lived up in Seattle, and he stayed in the dorms, and then he'd go home on weekends. He wore pince-nez glasses. He had a shock of sandy hair, kind of a little curl in it, sparse and thin on top. He used rulers. He'd always pound his ruler on the table of his desk. He had a table up in front of his classroom. Pound on that thing, and of course he'd break about one a day. One time he got one that wouldn't break. He kept pounding and pounding, and the harder he pounded, the worse the thing just wouldn't break. Finally, in desperation, he lifted up his knee, and he took this ruler in each hand, and that is, each end of the ruler held onto it, and then brought the thing down on his knee in the middle and snapped it off and threw it. Then he got a big smile on his face, and the kids just roared. Another time in class, he was a pretty shrewd old guy of history and political science. He said one day, he was telling us in the second floor classroom there in what's now Harstead Hall, he said, someday the Japanese are going to invade America. He said, that's where the threat's coming from. This, my friends, was back in 1934. He was a prophet, in a sense. Well, anyway, he was talking about the Japanese invasion, possibility of invasion. And when he no sooner got these words out of his mouth than there was a terrific crash. Window went out, and in the interior of the classroom came a golf ball. Some kid was outside, and his aim wasn't very good, and he sent this thing through. But it scared us half to death. This rash, especially after he mentioned about Japanese invasion. Peter Jeremiah was a, as I said, very colorful person. Another professor at that time was Nils J. Hong. He was English prof, taught all the English sections, and also was advisor to the student paper, The Mooring Mast. I was editor of that, so he worked with, and he was a fine fellow to work with. He was a very dignified person who was kind of aloof from the student, never got close to the students. He was of the old school, where he kind of held himself aloof, but he was very friendly and willing to talk and things of that nature. When it came to business, but when it came to other things, he just wasn't, never close to students, socially. Then there was Andrews W. Ramstead. Rammy came to PIU back in about 1925, I guess, or 26 somewhere. He'd been a pastor over in Bremerton when he came down to PIU. Yeah, 25, I think he came. Maybe he was 24. Anyway, he was the first, he's organized football. He played football at St. Olaf before he graduated in 1914 for going to Luther Seminary. He had a big raw-bone tackle, farm boy from down there in near Kenyon, Minnesota, right outside of Northfield. Well, Rammy was a teacher of chemistry. He coached the football team to begin with. Started up in 1926, and he also had girls' basketball. And he'd go on weekends preaching. Quite a versatile fellow. Then as the years went by, Cliff Olson came over from Spokane College. When they closed the doors of that school and merged it with PLU, in a sense. And Cliff came over and took over the athletic program. And then Ramsey stuck to his teaching. He also taught mathematics. Ramstead had his own cow in those depression years when I was a student there, I remember. The cow used to graze right there on the campus. And Philip E. Hauge, who was a dean, was a registrar and dean. He had a cow too, which they fed on the campus and from ate on the lawn that is in the area back now where the dorms are Harsted, Hinderley and this Hong and Kreidler Halls. And the street, Witter Street went up there, and there's kind of a dirt road, went along that side of the campus, where the mall is now between Ordahl and Hong Hall, and between the administration building and Xavier and so forth. There was a street all that went down through there. So Hauge and Ramstead bring their cows over and stake them out there during the day, and then they'd come there and milk them in the evening, milk them in the morning and in the evening, and get enough milk for themselves, for their families, and also sometimes they'd have enough left over to sell to other people in the community. Ramstead became head of the chemistry department, and he was a one-man gang, and then he was joined by Bob Olson in 1947, and of course it gradually grew and grew as the years went by. But in recognition of the leadership and work which he gave the school in the fields of science and in other fields through the years, the school, the Regents voted to name the science hall after him, Ramstead Hall. Rammy is a man who knows people all over the place. He's got a good memory for names. He's very friendly and kind, outgoing, and he was beloved by his students. I enjoyed having him as a teacher in chemistry. He was an inventor of sorts. He invented a screen, which is a forerunner of, a movie screen, which is a forerunner of the big screens we have now, so that you could see it was convex, so that you, no matter where you sat in the room, there wouldn't be a distortion image. And the Shearer Company was going to market this thing, but he'd... Ramstead. Rance had a patent on this screen, but there were ways of getting around this as far as competitors were concerned, and the result was he never did get much out of it. And he was also active in this gold mine up in McCall, Idaho, called the Kimberly Gold Mine. That was going to make PLU rich. And Kimberly Gold Mine, that's a saga in itself. It goes back to the mid-1930s. 1936, I think. Some gold was discovered up there, and a fellow by the name of Rolf Preuss, J.C.K. Preuss's son, he's dead now. He went up there, and there's a fellow named Daniel Flucktree, who had graduated from PLU and then gone and taken some engineering at the University of Washington. He went up there. They went up there in the 36, 37, 38, somewhere in there. And it looked like they were going to, jeebus, it looked like the real thing. So people began to invest money in this thing. They started selling. And the deal was this, that for every, I think it was for every 10 shares you bought, Pacific Lutheran would get one share free. Well, today Pacific Lutheran has about 150,000 shares in this gold mine, I think, something like that. They would carry them on the books at $1 a piece, at $1 for the whole thing. Someday it might be worth something, who knows? Now, just in 74, where the two outfits merged, I mean, another outfit merged with Kimberly, and it's called the Lee Silver Mines, and took over the stock, and who knows, maybe they might go in there. There is some gold there. They tried running it there in the late 30s, but it didn't. They never got enough to make anything to speak of because of the cost of getting out of there. And then the war came along, so the thing was closed down. I'd say they're closed for quite a few years until the 1950s. Late 1950s, they resurrected it again, got the thing started up again. But see, the gold price was tagged at $34 an ounce, whereas they got good ore out of there and got it down to the refinery in Utah, they still weren't able to come out ahead. They couldn't make any money on it, so they closed it down again. A lot of people got interested in the 1956, 50 to 1960 in there, and boy, if you didn't buy any stock in there, you were crazy. So I remember I bought 100 shares for $1 a piece, and it's not worth it. It's worth 10 cents a share now, but you can't sell it. I mean, there's nobody going to buy it, but that's what it's carried at, is 10 cents a share. Well, some people put thousands in that thing, and don't have anything to show for it, but you can't tell. Maybe someday it'll pan out. Then another Dan Flucktree was an interesting individual. I remember he used to write a column for the Morning Mass when I was editor, very philosophical, and remember, he married a girl. He liked a girl there at PLU, but he didn't dare tell her. He was an immigrant from Norway. He was a shy and bashful, and he'd talk to her through the columns of the Morning Mass and describe her and tell her how much he thought of her. Well, it didn't work, but he did marry one of the Olsen girls. Bertha. But then he died of TB, and Bertha has since remarried. She remarried shortly thereafter with a fellow named Talk, and they lived down in California. Well, there's another family, the Olsons. Their father was the fireman, or heating engineer for the school. And did some janitor work. You kept the fires burning in Harstad Hall. That was the heating unit for all three
all three buildings, for the chapel, for Arson Hall, and for the old gym when I was in school. And then when the library was built, which is now Xavier Hall, that was hooked up to the heating unit, which is there in Arson Hall. That heating unit was a big furnace, which was, when I was there, was hog fuel was run by sawdust. Then later it was switched over to oil. Now it's gas. Al Olson, his younger son Henry went to school with me. His son Arnold, who went to school there, and who later who for a number of years in the late 40s and early 50s was the cook school, in the cafeteria at school, and he later went to work for Central Meat Market downtown, and that's where he is still to this day, I think. It's a meat cutter. And there were daughters, three daughters that I don't know, Bertha, Helen, I think it was, and I forget the name of the other one. They all went to Peoria. That was quite a family. Of course, then there was a Fadness family. Mr. Fadness was a night watchman in Harstead for the school in Harstead Hall. And he used to come out at 11 o'clock at night and work until 7 in the morning. He had daughters Irene and Ruth. Irene Corbin, she lives in Parker. Ruth lives in Meyer, lives in Tacoma. She worked in the business office for a number of years. She retired here about 5 years ago or so. And then there were two sons, John, who was director of athletics at Lincoln High School in Tacoma, and who married a girl, Shirley Savage, who went to PLU. John and Troy were at school when I was there. John was an outstanding football player. He played center on a football team. That was in the days when he bounced back and forth. He went to PLU for 2 years, then he went over to UPS, which was CPS then, and he played for them, played football over there, and went to school, and then he came back to Pacific Lutheran again and played. So he was back and forth. When I saw him, he had been at PLU and UPS, and then he's back at PLU again when I played with him there. There's another brother, Lawrence, who lives out towards Roy. So there were four of them who went to PLU. Old Mr. Fadness was a real short fellow. He was about 5'3", 5'4". Nice fellow who worked hard taking care of the building at night, and supervising and checking us in and out. We'd come at all hours. We had to sign in if we got in after 12 o'clock. Ring the bell, and he let us in. We have to sign our names. Sometimes we'd get in 1, 2 o'clock in the morning. We knew it was kind of late. We'd sign our name, George Washington, Abraham Lincoln, and so forth. He'd watch us sign, and he'd laugh, and he was very friendly. He was very good about it all. Once in a while, he'd say, oh, okay, you guys, let's shrimp up now and do this right. Sometimes he'd let us get away with it. And we had another fellow, of course, who was very friendly and kind. Was on the staff for many, many years, and so was his wife, was Barrett S. Hinderly. Hinderly Hall is named after him and members of his family who served at the school. He was on the staff, his wife. Hinderly was a janitor there for many, many years. His wife was a cook for many years, and son Ed was on the maintenance staff until he retired about two years ago, yeah. He still lives in Parker. The folks are dead. And there was another son named Ray, went to PIO with me, and he's had a son at PIO. Freddie was a good golfer, very good golfer, on the golf team at school. Then there was a daughter, Ida, and Ida was married a fellow named Henry Berenson. Ida taught in Parkland for many, many years. She was married to, and Henry Berenson, her husband, was on the staff at PLU. I suppose he joined around 46, 47, somewhere in there, and was there until he retired 2 years ago. I think he retired in 73 or 72, somewhere in there. Now his son, their son in turn, David, is a member of the development staff at PLU. So Dave's ties with the school go back quite a ways. And, Barrett Hinderly, I remember he was watching him sweep, and he was my boss when I was going to school, and my job was to sweep the third floor hallway once or twice a week. He was my supervisor, and he'd give me the brooms and the sawdust and oil sawdust to sweep up the place. And then when I came to PLU in 1947 as a member of the staff, he owned a home there at 513 Grant Street, now 513 South 121st, South 123rd, across the alumni house there. He built, he rented that house to us. And after we moved out of there, when I went, when I got stationed in Seattle, my family joined me there. Korean War in 52, fall in the summer of 52, Henry's daughter, Gladys Windblade, moved in there. And she was on the staff at PLU. Now, I forgot to mention Gladys Goodnight. There's another Henry who was on the staff. Gladys, I suppose, was on the staff for 25 years as a housekeeper. And she was cleaning lady mostly in Harstad Hall. I mean, yeah, Harstad, when it was offices, and then over in the administration building, and also in the president's home. So she did a lot of things around the school. So we had four Henderleys that went to PLU. Then we had we have other interesting people around there. Think of the Leslie Eklunds. Les Eklund came to PLU in about 48, I think it was, somewhere in there, 47, 48. As Dean of Men, yeah, 48 he came up from Grace Harbor Community College. And he lived in the apartment, which is an apartment which is located at the southwest corner of Harstad Hall. I lived there, the Snackenbergs had lived there before him, and other different ones had lived in there through the years. Well, they had a son named Junior, and he'd ride up and down the halls on his kitty cart and so forth and so on. Go to the registrar's office, so forth. Well, then, it was getting to be too much to have Junior around there in the building, so they, we obtained a house which was located down where Flieger Hall is now. It was the old Munson house, the Munson family. Oh, there's another family of 29 kids that went to PLU. I'll talk about them when I come up next. Well, the Munsons had lived there for a number of years. They were there when I was going to school. And Eklund moved down there and lived in that little house. And it was called the Eklund House after a while. And little Junior used to run around his kitty cart. And I remember we had a fellow by name Nils Vangen. Nils Vangen is still around, you know, he's a retired preacher. He's an uncle to Stu Govig. Govig's mother and Mrs. Vangen were sisters. Well, anyway, one day down there, Eastwell had given Vaughan orders, and he said, now don't let anybody play on that tennis court other than tennis players. It's not a place for people to run around on bicycles and all this sort of stuff. So Junior was out there. Junior Eklund was out there riding around. And what's his name? Logan came along and kicked him off, see? He was a janitor for the lower campus, which was mostly at that time was the Memorial Gymnasium. Mrs. Eklund didn't take too kindly to this whole thing. She got mad as hops, and she came out there and with a broom and started hitting Vaughan over the head and said, tell him to leave her kid alone. Of course, that story went all over the campus. We had all kinds of fun over that one. I was going to talk about the Munsons. Munsons lived in that little house. And then here was it. There were four kids. Or was it five? Let's see, there's Clarence is the oldest, and Evelyn, and Bob, and Mildred, you know, four of them. They were all in school with me. Mildred was the youngest. She had a beautiful, and they all were good singers, all beautiful voices, all sang in the Choir of the West, and were good soloists. Mildred, we called her Mid, M-I-D. She sang the solo for Beautiful Savior under Jewel Edwards. Well, the Munson family had kind of rough going financially, but those kids all got by, and they all went out in the teaching profession, all made good. Clarence is dead, but the rest of them are still living. Bob is a teacher out in Kent. Evelyn and Mildred, I think, are both down in California. Well, I haven't seen him for a number of years, except Bob. I see him quite often. Then there's, what was I talking about there? Oh yeah, about Joe Edwards. There's another interesting guy. Joseph Edwards came out from Sinhoff in about 1932 to be director of music. And his wife, Artie, I think it was Artie. Yeah, Artie. She was a Sinhoff graduate too, and she was good in drama. So she wasn't on the faculty, but she used to help out by directing a play every spring. I remember I had a role in a play. I was a butler in a play that she directed. She also directed a musical that we put on. We had a lot of fun with her. They had a little son, David. Mrs. Edwards came from Henning, Minnesota, and Joe's father was a pastor up in Everett. Joe had a twin brother named Ben who was a teacher of music down at Fullerton, California. He was there at Fullerton College until he retired, and he also taught some at USC. He's a good musician, and Joe was a good musician. Joe's father was O.J. Edwards. He was pastor of Central Lutheran in Everett until he retired, and he died up there in Everett. Well, Joe was a lot of fun. He had the, you know, those were the days when school, they didn't want to let anybody know how they got pitch in the choirs. So he had a mouth organ that he had fixed up a rig with a little bulb on it that you'd squeeze. The person who gave pitch would squeeze, and the thing would slide back and forth on a track alongside the mouth organ, along the key of the openings of the mouth organ. And so if it was going to be C way, the person would move it over to where the C was. He'd look down and move it over where the C was, and then push on this bulb, and then the sound would come. And people always wondered where in the world the sound came for the Choir of the West. They'd ask us, how do you get sound? What's the big secret? Nobody can tell. But it was kind of a kick. And the one who gave pitch one year was, it was one of the Munson girls one year. Another year was Irene O'Dell, who is now Mrs. Tim Tomrovic and lives in Parker. Anyway, Joe was a lot of fun. I remember one time we were singing in Chinook, in that little church down there. It was kind of wet, raining down there. But the rain had let up. There was no place for us to go between groups except to go out in the street, out in front of the church. And Joe came out there and he saw this bicycle sitting there. He was in his tails and everything else. And he hops on the bicycle and goes driving down the street. Well, when we... while he was halfway down the street, the kids up in the front thought that they got the signal to go back in, to march back in, so they started marching in. And the choir was, I was towards the end, looked around, we were waving at Joe to hurry up, and he comes tearing down to catch up to us, you know, to come back in the church. So he wouldn't be late. Well, when he got there, we were the last ones going in, we looked around, and here was Joe roaring up in a bicycle and slamming on the brakes, and it was on a wooden sidewalk, and the bicycle went out from under him, and he ended up in a heap on the sidewalk. And we're all standing there looking at, we're having a tough time keeping a straight face, and the girls in the front row, they're already up front, they see this thing happen, and they're snickering, and Joe picks himself up and wipes himself off, you know, tries to clean himself up. Before coming in there, we're all standing up there watching him out in the narthex, the church, cleaning himself off before he could come in. And he came in there real dignified looking, you know, and as though nothing had happened. And here's pants were all wet. Oh, it was a scream. Never a dull moment with that fellow around. He had a heart of gold. Joe stayed around until I think 36, and then he took this job down in Fresno is where he went. Yeah, he was public school music down in Fresno for a number of years, and he still lives down there in Fresno, he and his wife, Artie. But those were the... a little bit of... I'll go into the Choir of the West history some other time. That's a long story. But we should gotta start talk some more about some of these personalities we had at school. We had a lot of interesting students. We had when I was there in the 30s, we have newcomers that came over from Norway, and they'd come and take the short course, and they'd be there for a few months and live there in a dorm with us fellows. Kind of died out by the 30s, it was more in the 20s. And we had seamen. I remember one, we had a fellow by the name of Potter that came there. He had met a guy by the name of Gunderson. Gunderson, whose dad had the, Gunderson was the tailor downtown Tacoma. And this guy Potter, he was an older fellow. Well, he was older for us, you know, I was 18, and there was this guy, he was 30 years old, living with us. And he was always trying to get us to play games, play poker with him. Of course, card playing was against the rules, but he'd get in the room and he always wanted to play Red Dog. Well, Red Dog was a game none of us knew anything about. We didn't dare play it with him because we knew he'd make up the rules as he wanted, and he'd take everything we had from us, so we never played Red Dog with him. But and of course, he'd take a snort of alcohol once in a while, and we thought that was terrible. So Potter couldn't figure out us poor babes in the woods that hadn't been around much. There was another fellow there by the name of Clifford Mesford, M-E-S-F-O-R-D, down in Astoria, Oregon. He was a real character, more fun. He was a dorm union president. We took care of our own discipline, I remember, and he used to preside at the meetings and we'd have more fun. He'd try to be dignified and conduct them in a certain way, and we'd give them all kinds of jazz, of gas rather. And he'd, come on fellas, this is serious business, he'd say. And we'd all roar. But during his regime, I remember one thing he'd heard about the Beltline at Luther. And the Beltline is when some kid would get out of line, or we'd go up on the third floor of the dorm, And every guy in the dorm would we'd form a line the whole length of the dorm, and the fellows would be lined up on each side about 6 feet apart, or 8 feet, whatever it was. And we'd take our belts off, and this guy would have to run through the line, bent over, exposing his buttocks, but not bare, but he'd take his pants off and he could go through in his shorts on. And every guy would get a whack at him. And this was a punishment that was introduced to him. And when any guy would hear the possibility of the belt line for his actions, where he'd usually shape up, we wouldn't have much trouble. But I remember one time, I suppose I'd have been caught if it hadn't been that I was out with a girl that night who lived off campus. I came back to dorm, and boy, the place was in all kinds of problems. Cliff Olson was there, the dean of men, and he was chewing everybody out. And I couldn't figure out what was wrong, and I found out that all the guys had gone up to the girls' dorm on the other side of the building, and they were having a lot of fun up there. They weren't doing anything, they were just out in the halls, but they came down from there, got the word that somebody to get out of there. So they came roaring down the stairs, and here was old Professor Stewart standing at the bottom of the stairs with his hands on saying, "Stop, stop, stop," and everybody ran past him. Nobody stopped. So he reported him. Cliff was chewing the gang out, and he says, "Now you got to have some punishment for this." And there were seven of us out of the 30, some guys in the dorm. I think there were 30 of us in the dorm that year. So there were seven of us who weren't along. The other 23, we had to figure out some kind of punishment. The punishment was this, that they would be campused for 2 weeks. That means they couldn't go off the campus for 2 weeks. So that was quite a time. Their girlfriends would, so I remember a couple of the guys had girlfriends off campus, Harold Dempster and Glenn Gustafson. These girls would come and see them. They'd sit around out on the campus, and it was in the spring of the year. And they'd sit out in front of Harstad there and talk until it was time for them to go up in the dorms. They had to be in Sears in the buildings by 8 o'clock, I think it was. And they couldn't leave the campus. Oh, that was a... But the fellows adhered to it, and nobody broke it. Strange thing. The other seven of us, we had a police... our job supposedly was to police them, but we didn't have to do anything. In fact, we didn't go off the campus much ourselves, because we thought, well, if those guys had to stay, we might as well stay too. So I remember I didn't go off much, except I was editor of the Morning Mail, and I had to go downtown, take the stuff down there to the print shop. When it came to other things, we stayed right around the place. We didn't, when it came to, social life on the campus, we make up our own campus, our own things. I remember on Saturdays, in the spring and fall, we used to, well, not in the fall because we had football, but on Saturdays in the spring, the kitchen would fix us up a picnic lunch, and we'd carry this, we'd divide it up amongst ourselves, and we'd hike out to Lake Spanaway and have a picnic lunch out there and come back, or we'd go some other direction. But we'd go for long walks on Saturdays, and we really enjoyed that. And we'd have parties and things of that nature that we'd get together by ourselves. We were pretty good at taking care of ourselves. Now, another campus personality that I haven't mentioned, of course, is Dr. Philip Hauge, who was the registrar and dean. He taught psychology and handled the other affairs, the academic affairs of the school. And he was, his wife was a good singer. She, along with Mrs. Ella Olson, and Mrs. Flieger and Mrs. Ramstead had a quartet. They called it the Faculty Wives Quartet. We kids used to call it the Fire Engine Quartet. I don't think they know that, and I wouldn't want to say that. So please don't pass it on to them before they're gone. Wait till they're gone, but, and their families are still, and their husbands are gone. Because they wouldn't appreciate it. We did it because we'd have a lot of fun about that. That was the Havoc Boys and I that called it that amongst ourselves. But then that nickname spread and was heard all over the area. But they were good singers and they did a good job at various affairs, school and church events throughout the Pacific Northwest. Faculty members used to have us over at their homes once in a while too. Friendly that word. But to get back to Haughey. Haughey was a fellow that was, for the most part, he was. He was fair and honest in his dealings with the students. He was kind of, he was always a man who felt that he should maintain his position as then, and he was somewhat aloof from students. That was the way things were in those days. A lot of the professors were aloof in a sense, although you always felt that they were part of the family and so forth, but you didn't want to bother with them a lot of stuff because they were busy people and they were teaching a lot of courses and had a lot of responsibilities. Haughey was a man who was dean, and then when the war came along in 42, he went in service, and he served overseas as a colonel in the Army, lieutenant colonel, and later became a colonel when he was discharged. And he came back to Pacific Northwest after the war. His family stayed there during the war. Had two children, Lawrence is his brother. Yeah, well, Lawrence is his son, Larry, sure, Larry. And a daughter, Mrs. Ralph Carlson. Janet's her name. Her husband's president of Centralia Community College, and